From ABC News, this is Perspective, this week's stories and why they matter. I'm Daria Albinger. Coming up, the spread of the Delta variant, what it means for masking up and returning to school.
If you're in a community that has a lot of COVID, that community may decide that they're going to mask.
Breaking down the first 6 months of Joe Biden's presidency.
He did not want to just push a two-year agenda or four-year agenda, but looking long-term.
And Judge Esther Salas, 1 year after the murder of her son, discussing how she'll carry out his legacy.
Everything I do from this moment on is for Daniel. He sacrificed his life for his father and me.
All ahead on Perspective. In testimony on Capitol Hill this week, the nation's top infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, pleaded with Americans to put politics aside and get vaccinated as the Delta variant continues to spread rapidly through the U.S.
We have the tools to end this epidemic. It is up to us to utilize those tools to their maximum.
Cases and hospitalizations are increasing across several states, including California, where ABC's Alex Stone has the latest on mask requirements for the state.
Daria, the numbers that we have seen here in LA County over the past week are numbers not seen since February. It has been many months since numbers have been this high in LA County. A month ago, we were looking at about 200 cases a day. In the past week, it has been over 2,500, 2,700 cases a day in the county, a 20-fold increase over just a couple of weeks ago. And doctors here in Southern California, they really go back to this is mainly the unvaccinated who are getting sick, going into hospitals, needing to go on ventilators. Dr. Victor Waters is treating patients here in Southern California.
I'm dismayed. I'm frustrated by the lack of community commitment and drive to get these vaccines started. It seems such a simple solution, but has turned into a big mess.
The vaccination numbers have gone up in LA County for the first time since the beginning of May. All of the news out there about young people getting seriously ill, now those who are waiting are getting vaccinated. And LA County masks are mandatory if you're indoors now in any public place. Out in Las Vegas, in the past week, they have voted anybody who's working, they've got to put masks back on. And in Northern California, in San Francisco, Contra Costa, and Santa Clara counties, some of the largest in Northern California, health officers are now strongly urging all employers to implement requirements that everybody be vaccinated. It's not mandated, but they're going to businesses and saying, look, you can mandate your workers as a condition of employment to be fit for employment. You can mandate that they be vaccinated. They're asking for companies to do that now. Daria?
The overwhelming majority of those hospitalized by COVID-19 are unvaccinated. Our Brad Melke spoke with former CDC Director Dr. Tom Frieden about the spread of Delta and how it could impact all of us on the ABC News Daily podcast. Start here.
How concerned should we be here about breakthrough infections?
We have to remember that vaccines are not 100%. When we say these vaccines provide great protection, they do. But it's not perfect protection. And that means that some people who are vaccinated are going to get infected. They're going to be fully vaccinated people who, as the Delta variant spreads and there are high levels of disease in community, are going to get breakthrough infections. Most of those will be mild. Some of them will undoubtedly be less mild. Some end up in hospitalization and in very rare cases could end up in death. That doesn't change the underlying reality that vaccination is the best way to protect ourselves from COVID.
Say you're vaccinated, maybe you got some sniffles, maybe you've been around somebody who recently tested positive. You go and you get tested, and you test positive. What are you supposed to do next? Because, I mean, I was kind of surprised to learn that the CDC doesn't necessarily recommend you go into some two-week lockdown.
And if I can just step back and make a broader comment.
Sure.
The best responses to public health challenges adapt based on data. And I know that's frustrating for people because people want absolute answers. But really, if you look at the very best programs ever run in public health, they were constantly adapting because as we learn more, we learn how to protect people better. If you're living with someone who's at high risk of serious illness, you need to be very careful around that person. And certainly, if you are testing positive, even if it's after vaccination, you should not be exposing that person because they could become severely ill.
Are you trying to tell me that we should be wearing more masks? Is that what we should be doing?
There are a couple things going on with masks. Unfortunately, they've been made into such a partisan issue. And that really is unfortunate because even if COVID didn't exist, it would be a good idea for us to wear masks more than we do, as they do in East Asia. That saves lots of lives in flu season. So I hope we don't get into a situation where there's any stigma whatsoever from wearing a mask. All of that said, because cases are rising, there are certain circumstances in which masking may well make sense. First off, you have to ask who, what, and where. If you are immunosuppressed, even if you've been vaccinated, you probably want to wear a mask if you're in a really crowded place.
Right.
Second, what you're doing. If you're in an enclosed space with rising case counts, there's no practical way to know who's vaccinated and who's not. So everyone should wear a mask in that setting. And it's also about where you are. So again, if you're in a community that has a lot of COVID, then that community may decide that they're going to mask because that is the safest thing to do for people. It is a little puzzling to me why there's such opposition to masks, because masks are actually our way of doing more things that we'd like to do.
Former head of the CDC, Dr. Tom Frieden, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you so much.
The coronavirus is continuing to spread through Japan as the Olympics get underway. We wanted to get an idea for what it's like on the ground in Tokyo. For that, we turned to ABC's Jim Ryan, who arrived there a few days ago. What's the mood like there among the athletes and the officials and just people in Tokyo?
Well, I think the athletes are feeling enthusiastic about it. They know that there are restrictions. Many of them now, some people associated with the Olympics, have tested positive for COVID. That means some athletes won't be competing at all, Daria. I think the organizers of the events here are hoping that once the games are underway in earnest, that people will kind of forget about COVID or forget about the pall that it's cast over this whole thing. Among the people of Tokyo, you're not going to see people in the stands, obviously, because of COVID, and you're more likely to hear voices like these in the streets. Protesters are calling for a stop to the games and for the resignation of the Olympic officials from Japan. The Japanese organizers, the Japanese Olympic Committee, say that they still reserve the right to cancel the games if COVID gets out of hand, Daria.
So many have questioned if these games should have even happened at all.
Yeah.
What might it mean for the Olympics going forward?
Every cycle seems to have some issue. If you look back, well, 5 years ago now, at the Summer Games in Rio de Janeiro, Zika was the big factor there that people were concerned about, that it might interrupt the game somehow. Well, it didn't. And again, once the games were underway, people seemed to forget about that largely. Before that, the Winter Olympics in Sochi, I was covering that in Russia. People were very concerned about the threat of terrorism. And again, the games went off essentially without a hitch. You know, I think that every game has its issues, every Olympiad has challenges, and yet somehow they get through it, Daria.
So you are an Olympics veteran. So what is this like for you this time? Not just from a reporting standpoint, reporting on the Olympics rather standpoint, but, you know, on a reporting standpoint in general, how do you compare this to other stories that you've covered?
Well, it is very restrictive. And just getting here was a real challenge. The flight from Dallas to San Francisco to connect me to the airport here to Narita was delayed at Dallas, okay, because of weather. That happens occasionally. But not only did I miss the connection to get into Japan, but my COVID test also expired. You had to have a test within 72 hours of leaving the country. So it meant getting another test in an emergency basis to ensure that I could get on the plane and come to Japan. The wait at the airport upon arrival, the testing there that was happening, took about an hour and a half. And then daily testing, spitting into a little tube and handing that off to somebody to ensure that I'm okay. You know, the first 3 days in quarantine. It's difficult to do much of anything except, you know, stay in your room and try not to get sick.
We have two sports that have returned for these games that the USA has a pretty good chance of meddling in, and that's baseball and softball. They're finally back. Why?
It used to be that the International Olympic Committee would make all the choices about which games were going to be on the roster in any given year. Well, it was decided at some point that the host country would get to choose a couple of games too. Baseball is very popular here in Japan, as everyone knows. And so for the first time since 2008, baseball slash softball will be played here in Tokyo. I think it'll be interesting to watch the 3-on-3 women's basketball this year. That'll be new. It's a faster game. There's a lot more contact. It's an exciting thing, with or without a crowd in the stands area.
ABC's Jim Ryan reporting from Tokyo. It's been 6 months of the Biden administration. For every president, that is a critical time. His first task was continuing to lead the country through the coronavirus pandemic, and he's pushed for big policy changes. So what do Americans make of President Biden's first 6 months, and what's ahead for his administration? ABC's Michelle Franzen talked about that with ABC News political contributor Donna Brazile.
How has the 6 months come across for not only President Biden, but for his administration?
I believe that President Biden and Vice President Harris have made meaningful progress toward the America we believe in. They've taken meaningful action and helping to provide relief to handle the pandemic. They've made available vaccines so that the American people can get back on their feet. They're helping small businesses, helping renters who are faced with foreclosure. And I think the most important thing now is to get our schools back open this fall and to continue to make meaningful progress on investing in the lives of the American people.
Let's talk about the agenda in this first 6 months. It's been huge, and dealing with the pandemic all on its own would be significant enough, but there's a lot of other stuff going on too.
What you're seeing is this, what I call a long list of policy objectives that will increase investments into the American people in terms of getting people back to work, reopening our schools, but also looking long term. He did not want to just push a 2-year agenda or 4-year agenda, but looking long term in terms of strategic investments in our infrastructure, making sure that our manufacturing sector can come back. So I think he has approached governing the same way he has approached his entire leadership and public service over the last 4 decades, and that is to come up with an agenda that unites people and also to make those investments in key crucial areas in our economy.
These policies seem to be interconnected, as you mentioned, in the long-term goal effort: infrastructure, jobs, voting rights, jobs, wages, jobs. Is that where we're headed for the next 6 months, continuing on this path?
Making sure that our schools reopen safely, ensuring that we can have some resources to help parts of the economy that are still ailing, like the hospitality industry, making sure that the American people are equipped and prepared for what's ahead, not just looking backwards, but also looking forward. So you'll see another round of making sure that he gets his budget through, the reconciliation package is approved, the infrastructure package is approved. And then at that point, it's all about implementation, making sure that he's delivering for the American people.
Let's look ahead. The next 6 months, you know, we're going to be entering, if we haven't already, the next political election.
The campaign season that is upon us is going to be a very challenging season. It comes after redistricting, where Democrats are looking to lose seats in several parts of the country. Before we get to the 2022 all-important midterm cycle, you have to look at the elections coming up over the next couple of months, whether it's mayoral elections or the 2 gubernatorial elections that we have to deal with. Joe Biden will be campaigning for Terry McAuliffe in Virginia and Phil Murphy in New Jersey.
And part of that will continue on with the voting rights and protection efforts that Democrats say are needed to go up against Republican-led states passing measures Democrats call restrictive.
In his inaugural address to the nation, President Biden said to the American people that our democracy was preserved. But most recently, he said that this is the biggest test since the Civil War. The key ingredient in any democracy is the freedom to vote. And whenever barriers are erected that prevent certain Americans from exercising their freedom to vote, it's important that the administration, be it a Democratic administration or Republican administration, address some of these deficiencies to ensure that no American is ever turned away from the ballot box.
ABC's Michelle Franzen speaking with ABC News political contributor Donna Brazil. Another task at hand for the Biden administration is bringing children back to the classroom safely. And it isn't only the children's physical health that people are concerned about, but their mental health too. ABC's Rena Roy has more on that story.
11-year-old Ion Mukherjee got his first computer when he began remote learning last spring.
When virtual learning began, you got your very first laptop. What was that like?
I mean, it was very exciting because I usually had to, like, share devices with people in my family.
But he says in just a matter of days, things were getting out of hand.
I started with a couple of videos, then I started watching more and more. I watched every free moment I had.
And it turns out our brains are wired to keep watching. It taps into the more survival and pleasure-based centers of the brain, driving us to watch that next episode or just one more video from a creator we love on YouTube. It's a constant battle between immediate pleasure and self-control, making us pretty exhausted. Dr. Heather Berlin, a neuroscientist and clinical psychologist, says it's taking a toll, particularly on kids.
Studies show that with children, the longer amount of time they spend on screens, the worse their social and emotional development.
Ion's mother, Dr. Preethika Mukherjee, is a neuropsychologist herself and tells us she noticed an immediate shift in his behavior, saying he was extra tired, moody, and irritable.
He's usually not this dysregulated. He's a very even-keeled, calm kid.
According to the Mayo Clinic, excessive screen time in kids has been linked to loss of social skills, behavioral problems, less sleep or irregular sleep, obesity, and even violence. Lindsay Reckler, a mother of two, has been working and parenting from home like millions of Americans for over a year now.
When you're fully plugged in, you lose a little bit of sense of boundaries.
She's had to balance her own screen time as a busy director at an investment bank with that of her young children learning from home.
We went from don't take mom and dad's iPad to here's your own. Taking that iPad away after that virtual session is over proved to be very difficult.
Especially as the internet became the vital link to the outside world.
They went from interacting with every day, going to the playground, seeing their friends, to just pure isolation.
Dr. Berlin says that in person, our brains subconsciously pick up on cues like body language and touch to help us respond appropriately in social settings. But on platforms like Zoom, these cues are missed, and the brain adjusts to a digital world of disrupted conversations, exaggerated expressions, and a lack of eye contact. Scientists say our intimacy with loved ones is really suffering. One surprisingly important thing our brains are missing out on is smell. It's the only sense that can go straight from sensory receptors directly to the cortex, the primary sensory area of the brain, making it especially powerful and informative. Smell is also linked to empathy. It's a dizzying combination of effects on the human mind, and the long-term impact of all this zooming is still a mystery. For now, there are ways we can limit the impact. Ion has taken all devices out of his room and has created a set time limit with his parents for when he can use them.
It was hard at first, like in the first few days, first week, but as it went by, I felt more relieved that I wasn't spending as much time on the screen.
Even writing an open essay about his experience as a PSA for other kids.
What are you hoping the message is from your essay?
I'm hoping that it helps kids be less addicted to screen.
But still, we're likely to see an awkward transition when we have to adapt to the next normal. Reckler hopes her children will be able to readjust.
I think I need to teach my kids how to be a friend again.
The good news is that the human brain, especially when young, is very resilient.
With children, they're fortunate in the sense that they'll probably come out of this and be able to readapt. There might be certain critical periods of development that they miss, but I think that it'll be very quick for them to catch up.
Rena Roy, ABC News, New York.
Coming up, Love is Light. Judge Esther Salas explains what's next for her and her husband 1 year after the death of her son. That's ahead on Perspective.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
From ABC News, this is Perspective, this week's stories and why they matter. I'm Daria Albinger. Coming up, billionaires in space. But is that where they should be spending their fortunes? We'll discuss that later. But first, 1 year after the brutal murder of her son Daniel, Judge Esther Salas is on a mission to honor her son's life and legacy. This week, the federal judge from New Jersey opened up to ABC's Robin Roberts about how she and her husband are advocating for increased protection for federal judges and how they've coped over the past year.
Everything I do from this moment on is for Daniel. He sacrificed his life for his father and me.
It was the ultimate act of heroism. Judge Esther Salas' beloved son, Daniel, taking a fatal bullet after a gunman posing as a delivery driver attempted to assassinate Judge Salas at their home last summer. Her husband, Mark, suffering three gunshot wounds, but thankfully surviving.
How has this past year been, the roller coaster of emotions?
I don't want to sugarcoat some of the depths of our disparate moments. Mark, thank goodness, is thriving, but we had some scares. We're traveling this journey together.
Through that emotional journey, leaning on their faith and each other.
One of the things I learned about my husband was his resilience. He had crawled out to the porch to try to get a license plate. That was the first, you know, sign that this guy was just not going to stop.
Really, Mark?
Yes.
That was your thought.
It was a lot of adrenaline. I knew Daniel was not going to make it. Just from being with him, I just could tell. And he was in a state of grace, so I was happy. I went over to the other side very briefly. I was in the light, and I was assured, and I know that he's fine. So when I woke up and I saw Esther, I could tell her that.
Over time, Judge Salas says she found the strength to forgive her son's killer.
Love is light, and it's so true. You can't walk around with that burden of resentment, hate. It's like an anchor. It holds you down.
And how did you get to that place?
You know, I think it's my faith, and I realize that in some part it's important to forgive. It helps you be open to the love that people want to give you. And I think it helps the person that's injured to also move forward, not on, but move forward.
Part of moving forward begins here at St. Joseph High School.
And he loved it here.
Where Daniel loved to play baseball.
Angelic number 11.
What is it like that this field, this baseball field?
It's surreal. It's fantastic.
Do you feel the love? Do you feel the support?
Yes, yes, every day.
And all we can say is thank you. We will continue to fight because Daniel expects that from mom and dad.
Judge Salas now fighting for increased protection for her fellow judges through Daniel's Law, a bill reintroduced to Congress as threats against federal judges continue to rise.
What we're asking is that we protect our personal information, our home addresses, our social security numbers. This is what the shooter did in my case. He took all that available information, created a dossier, knew where I lived, knew my church, knew my husband's office, knew Daniel's school, knew this school. He even had games that Daniel had played in. And he used that information to target us. And that should be a grim reminder of what will happen if we do not do something to protect our judiciary.
What do you think it's going to take for it to become federal law?
I think we need to send a message. We are not going to allow the constitutional principles we've lived by to be attacked. It's not lost on me that this man hated me because I was a woman, but he also hated me because I was Latina. And when you attack people for who they are, you're challenging the very principles that we hold near and dear in this country, the principles of equality and justice for all.
And is it that spirit right there that brought you back to the bench?
Absolutely. Absolutely. This man took the most important thing in my life. He will take nothing else.
Judge Salas embracing each day with renewed purpose. The community helping to carry the torch, hosting the Love is Light 5K.
Good prevails today.
To help fund scholarships in Daniel's honor.
You know, Daniel, I like to say, I loved life and everyone in it. He loved to make his friends laugh, and he loved to make the most out of every moment. And I realized, you know what? Out of this senseless tragedy, his life makes sense. Makes sense.
Scores dead and many still unaccounted for after catastrophic flooding ripped through Western Europe. It's just another in a series of intense climate-related events which have played out over the past several weeks, from wildfires in the west to Hurricane Elsa in the east. ABC's Maggie Rooley has been covering the flooding and has more on how climate change is affecting infrastructure and livelihoods in some of the worst damage Germany has faced since World War II.
In Germany, entire communities are left picking through muddy rubble after what some are calling one of the worst disasters to hit the country since World War II. The death toll soaring to around 200 in Germany and Belgium. Nearly 300 are still missing. This level of destruction is difficult for survivors to comprehend.
There's so many people dead.
You don't expect people to die in a flood in Germany. You expect it maybe in poor countries, but you don't expect it here. But it was all too fast, too quick.
Satellite images show the scope of devastation in Germany. Here on the ground, that devastation is felt firsthand. People desperate to salvage what's left of their homes and their businesses.
How high was the water up to here?
That's right here.
Oh, wow.
This woman had a clothing business in Euskirchen, her livelihood now gone. Her neighbors are helping her save what they can. It's just them cleaning up for now. Outside help hasn't been able to reach them yet. In parts of Western Germany, the infrastructure has been completely upended.
Those floodwaters are so powerful, it just ripped through the pavement, cutting off towns.
Germany, Belgium, and parts of France were battered by heavy rains. But it was Germany that took the heaviest toll. The flash floods sweeping in at alarming speed. The result, the rains turning roads into debris-filled rivers, sweeping away cars, trapping people in their homes. Semi-trucks and cars tossed around like toys.
Those floods came ripping through here. They flipped cars, they flipped trucks into each other. Now, army personnel and tanks are here on a search and recovery mission, trying to drag these trucks out.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel paying a visit to the hard-hit city of Schuld, calling the damage shocking and surreal. And in the nearby medieval town of Achwiller, more than 110 people dying in that region alone. This man telling us how he barely escaped with his elderly mother alive. Many of the homes from the 1500s or older are now caked with thick mud. Many fear they all may have to be destroyed. As Germany remains in shock, scientists are predicting more frequent extreme events. Climate extremes are rocking our planet, often in the most unlikely places. Siberia has one of the coldest winters outside of Antarctica, but with temperatures climbing to above 100 degrees, they're now dealing with a catastrophic fire season for the third year in a row. And the implications are dire. The fires are destroying Russia's forests, which could potentially accelerate climate change. And the heat waves from Oregon to Canada, claiming the lives of hundreds of people late last month. The fires in California now raging, prompting evacuations south of Lake Tahoe. In Germany, local meteorologists say that what they've experienced is the worst flooding in at least 500 years. Perhaps no clearer sign that no one is immune from climate change.
I'm still not able to believe this is real.
It looks like a nightmare or like in a bad movie.
Maggie Rulli in Western Germany for ABC News.
The successful flights of Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic hope to pioneer commercial space travel, potentially in the near future. But how near? And is commercial space travel such a good idea with so much help needed here on planet Earth? ABC News producer Mike Dubusky tried to get those questions answered.
T-minus 10, 9, 8.
The world's richest man briefly left Earth this week.
Start. 2, 1.
Jeff Bezos, founder of Amazon, alongside his brother Mark Bezos, 80-year-old pilot and longtime aspiring astronaut Wally Funk, and Dutch teenager Oliver Damon blasting off in a Blue Origin rocket.
We have liftoff. Go, New Shepard, go.
Floating weightless.
That's incredible.
And then gently landing back on Earth in a secluded desert in West Texas.
And touchdown.
Oh, it was beautiful.
Absolutely spectacular.
All told, the trip took just over 10 minutes Tuesday morning, which is, by the way, the same day the Apollo 11 mission landed the Eagle Lunar Module on the moon in 1969. That trip eventually got a call from then-President Nixon.
Because of what you have done, the heavens have become a part of man's world.
No such luck on this trip, though Press Secretary Jen Psaki did mention it in the briefing room.
Investments in space create jobs, can improve life here on Earth through climate monitoring and medical advancements, just to name a few.
Those advancements she's talking about are ostensibly why all of this is happening. Once you strip back all the patriotism and the pageantry and the attention from the White House, the Apollo program was a series of research missions. Apollo 11 brought back nearly 50 pounds worth of moon rocks and lunar dust, teaching us all about the composition of the moon, solar winds, and contributing to our ever-growing understanding of the universe and our place in it. What's more, modern technologies ranging from aircraft piloting systems to integrated circuits and even freeze-dried food can all trace their origins in part back to the Apollo missions. This week's Blue Origin flight was smaller in scope than all that, just barely cresting what scientists largely agree is the border between our atmosphere and the vast expanse of space.
These are all very suborbital flights where it's barely space, but it's way more space than you and I have experienced.
That's Zach Hall, lead editor at the website Space Explored. He says despite its brevity, Bezos' trip to space did feature some scientific experiments, but they were similarly small in scope.
They are mixing in sort of what I think of as like inessential experiments. Some of those experiments that have been done so far are things that have been done without humans involved in these suborbital flights, but they add in the data from having a human component to it.
He says the bigger takeaway from the flight had more to do with shrinking down the amount of time it takes to prepare for space flight. The eventual goal is to make the trip easier for civilian passengers, but for now, the focus is on scientists trying to get to space.
Who haven't gone through the career path and training of being an astronaut that might one day fly, to flying instead experts in their own areas where they can work on their own experiments in zero gravity without having to become a full-fledged astronaut.
You're looking at the Unity spaceship from Virgin Galactic.
Bezos isn't the only extremely wealthy businessman to travel to the edge of space this month. Richard Branson, the man behind the Virgin Group and its spacefaring subsidiary Virgin Galactic, taking a different kind of spacecraft to the upper reaches of our atmosphere.
You know, you launch from the top of a rocket with Blue Origin, and then your capsule separates, and you come back down to Earth with a parachute and a soft landing. Virgin Galactic is more like taking off from an airplane and landing the same way.
It also must be said, he didn't go quite as high as Bezos did. Hall notes the timing of the two flights isn't accidental, especially when you consider that both Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic are around 2 decades old.
Part of it is just the amount of time it takes to, you know, slowly test the technology and make sure it's safe for humans before you have, you know, fatal accidents that destroys the company. But then also once they're both really close to the starting line of the actual competition with real customers, I think there is some movement there on how aggressive you become.
And just as the Russian and American space programs competed with one another in the 60s and 70s, so too are Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic engaging in a new private space race of their own.
It wasn't a government incentive for this kind of area to be explored before. And now there is this commercial incentive where if these companies can secure contracts from NASA without NASA paying the bulk of the load for making it possible, or better yet, paying customers so that one day this sort of flight will be like a flight across the country, then that will be the long-term benefit.
It's estimated about 20% of the world's population watched the moon landing in 1969. But not everyone was awed by Neil Armstrong's first steps.
We have a poem here. It's called Whitey on the Moon.
Poet Gil Scott Heron, in his song Whitey on the Moon, spoke of the stark racial divide in 1960s America that he saw as being overlooked by all those people with their eyes glued to the Apollo mission.
I can't pay no doctor bills, but Whitey's on the moon. 10 years from now, I'll be paying still while Whitey's on the moon. You know, the man just up.
This time around, the billionaire space race is prompting some of the same questions. Racial inequality, a climate crisis, and a world bruised by a devastating pandemic are just some of the problems critics argue are being ignored by the world's richest in favor of a few minutes of quite expensive weightlessness.
It's a question that I struggle with even, you know, to see, is it worth the investment? What could you do if you put the money elsewhere?
But Hall says there's another way to look at this.
I think that there's some problems that we face in our society today that aren't solved by billionaire investment, and that it's not that you get one or the other, that we're in a time right now where we're getting both. You know, I think it's a good thing that we've, however you feel about billionaires, that we have the billionaires risking their money versus having it be something that comes from the government.
Bezos echoed this sentiment in an interview with CNN earlier this week, saying he largely agrees with his critics.
We have lots of problems in the here and now on Earth, and we need to work on those. And we always need to look to the future. We've always done that as a species, as a civilization. We have to do both.
Though he didn't escape a protest anthem of his own, this time from comedian Bo Burnham earlier this summer. Reporting for Perspective, I'm Mike Dubusky, ABC News.
From ABC News, this has been Perspective. Thanks for listening. If you want to listen to any of our past shows, you can subscribe to the Perspective podcast. Give us a review if you've got the time. Tell us what you like and what you'd like to hear in the future. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find Perspective and other ABC News shows at abcnewspodcast.com. Perspective is produced by Eric Mollo. For ABC News, I'm Daria Albinger.